Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do viruses do to us, and what do they do for us? Although many of us hear that word and instantly think of the nasty bugs that make us sick, viruses, in fact, are all around us all the time, including trillions living in and on our bodies on any given day. Not only are most of them harmless to humans, many are actually vital to the health of the environment, and others might be harnessed to help cure disease. Carl Zimmer is a science writer who teaches at Yale University. His Full of Surprises new book is called A Planet of Viruses. Carl, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we'll start with this. What is a virus exactly?
Basically, a virus is a package of genes wrapped up in a protein shell. There are some variations on that, but that's what gives you the cold or the flu or so on. So it's different than your own cells or even from bacteria because it doesn't have any way to grow, to feed, and then to divide on its own. In order to reproduce, it needs a host that it can take over to make new viruses.
And they don't actually have cells themselves, is that correct?
Yeah, they're just little shells with just a few genes inside. And we have about 20,000 genes that make proteins in our genome, and you know, a flu virus has 10.
So how many viruses are there on planet Earth?
Well, there are a lot. That much scientists know for sure. The latest estimates I've seen is 10 to the 31st power. So you just write the number 1 and then write 31 zeros after that. And that's a lot. That makes viruses the most abundant life form on Earth by far. And illustration I like the most that I've come across is a scientist once decided to figure out how high viruses would go if you were to stack them one on top of the other, all the viruses on Earth. And he calculated that they would go 100 million light years. So they would just go out past all our neighboring galaxies.
And the way they reproduce themselves, as you mentioned, is by making their hosts do the work. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So... So let's say you get the flu. A virus comes in. Usually you breathe it in, so it comes in through your nose, or maybe you got a flu virus on your hand and it got into your mouth. In either case, it goes into your airway, and then that little virus settles onto a cell on the lining of your airway, and it's got sort of got keys on its surface that can slip into the locks on your cell surface, and they're quite exquisitely shaped to match the shape, so that they're able to open up your cell, and then the virus goes in, and then once it goes in there, it releases this genetic material, and it also may have a few proteins inside, and basically those proteins help to, in a sense, take over your cell to make more viruses instead of, you know, growing and dividing on its own. And then after a while, your cell actually makes lots of new viruses, which then break out of the cell and go off to infect other cells.
And the reason we feel so lousy with the flu and also with colds is actually a factor of our own immune systems.
Yeah, so it's often a couple different factors at playing together at once. So in the case of the flu, for example, you know, it is killing off a lot of cells in your airway, and that can actually allow other pathogens, bacteria, for example, to get in there and to make you even sicker. That's why flu can lead to pneumonia, for example. But at the same time, as you say, you know, your immune system is attacking the viruses and the infected cells. And, you know, our immune systems are very sophisticated, but they can be a little, they can do a little bit of overkill. And so you end up with a fever and you feel achy and there's swelling and so on. And a lot of that is brought on by your own immune system. And, you know, after your immune system has killed off all the viruses, it sort of subsides and your body's able to clear away all the wreckage, and that's when you start feeling better again.
So, Carl, most people know by now that there are what we call healthy bacteria, say, in the human gut. And in fact, there are viruses that are doing really good things for us all the time, despite the fact that some viruses make us very sick.
Yeah. So, I mean, for example, we are home to lots of viruses. The last estimate I saw was that we're each home to about 4 trillion viruses. Now, why don't they make us sick? Well, because they don't infect human cells. They, in fact, infect bacteria. Our bodies are actually home to trillions of bacteria, 10 times more bacteria than human cells, as a matter of fact. And so these viruses are constantly attacking those bacteria and probably, like, keeping their populations in check so that we have this ecosystem inside of us. And, you know, in a lot of ecosystems, you need predators to help keep things balanced. Well, these viruses may be our kind of internal predators keeping things in balance.
And they also keep the planet in equilibrium. I thought this was fascinating. Talk about the viruses in the ocean.
Sure. So, you know, a long time ago, people thought that there were practically no viruses in the ocean. They just thought that viruses couldn't handle floating around in seawater.
Mm-hmm.
But then about 25 years ago, a young graduate student named Lita Proctor was going through a book and saw some pictures of seawater taken through a microscope, and she thought she saw things that looked a lot like viruses there. And it made her think, well, you know, maybe we've just been assuming there are no viruses and we haven't looked carefully enough. And she started looking and started to find a lot of viruses, and she was quite surprised. And then other researchers, you know, when she started publishing results, they were skeptical, I guess, and they went and looked themselves, and they found again that the ocean was swarming with viruses. So if you go to the ocean with a spoon and you scoop up a spoonful of seawater, there might be a billion viruses just in that spoonful alone. And then, you know, just consider that extends across the entire ocean. You start to see that there's a colossal number of viruses there. And once again, they're infecting bacteria, because bacteria are far more abundant in the ocean than fish or corals or things that we're more familiar with. And this is really important, actually, for the whole chemistry of the ocean, because these bacteria, a lot of them are photosynthesizing, so they're actually drawing down a lot of carbon dioxide from the air.
Mm-hmm.
They're releasing oxygen. And these viruses are killing these bacteria in huge numbers. They actually kill half of all the bacteria in the ocean every single day. The bacteria grow back, of course, very quickly,
mm-hmm.
but you basically have this incredible churning of billions of tons of carbon every single day, because these bacteria are getting killed by viruses all the time.
And if we didn't have all those viruses, the ocean, it sounds like, would be a big swamp of cholera.
Well, yeah, actually, cholera is caused by bacteria, which often hang out in the ocean. That's one way that they can spread from one place to another and cause outbreaks. And there have actually been cases where scientists have found that there are viruses that will attack these bacteria, and they can attack them so fast that they might actually be able to stop outbreaks, because they can just wipe out the bacteria across, you know, many, many square miles. They're just so fast at it. So here's one case, actually one case among many, where viruses can actually help our own health.
So this all sounds good, and the ocean is, you know, in sort of homeostasis, but I wonder about what happens as the oceans get warmer and warmer. Does that throw off the balance?
That's a good question. We really don't know. And, you know, viruses might actually be playing a part in the climate right now. If viruses are altering how much carbon dioxide being taken down out of the atmosphere by bacteria, that could have a really big impact on how much heat is being trapped in the atmosphere and therefore how warm it is around the world. But, you know, scientists have just really discovered scale at which viruses are affecting the oceans, and so they haven't even begun to put numbers on this. We don't know. I mean, and it's possible that in a warmer world, the viruses will be infecting bacteria faster. What will that mean? We really don't know. It's possible that it might shoot more carbon dioxide back into the air, or maybe it might actually send it down to the bottom of the ocean and help to cool the planet. We just don't know yet.
And they do produce a significant amount of oxygen every day.
Yeah, this is, might sound kind of weird to think of viruses producing oxygen, but they do in a very bizarre, indirect way. One important thing to understand about viruses is that sometimes they don't just kill off their host cells. And so I told you about the flu. I mean, that's one way that viruses make a living. But there are other kinds of viruses that actually are much gentler on their host. They will actually insert their own genes into the DNA of their host, and then they sort of just disappear. I mean, they basically merge into their host's own DNA, and that's it. Later, they might break out and form new viruses, but not necessarily. And as these viruses go from host to host and insert their genes into new hosts, they actually can pick up some host genes and bring them along. So you have this bizarre kind of sort of natural genetic engineering going on. And the scientists have found that there's some viruses that float around in the ocean carrying with them a bunch of genes that are essential for photosynthesis.
Hmm.
And they'll infect bacteria that beforehand couldn't do photosynthesis. And they will plug in their genes, and basically the bacteria sort of powers up as a solar power plant. I mean, all of a sudden they can start capturing sunlight and turning that into biomass. And so these viruses are giving the bacteria the ability to do photosynthesis. And now the bacteria are taking in carbon dioxide and they're giving out oxygen. And we breathe some of that. So it might be as much as 10% of the oxygen we breathe ultimately comes from viruses.
So going back for a minute to influenza, this is, as you mentioned, a 10-gene virus. We really hate it. What makes it typically a disease of the winter months?
So with the flu goes from person to person in little droplets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we get the flu, we get all congested, we're coughing, we're sneezing, we're feeling terrible, and these little droplets that we release, they go off into the air, and they then might land on somebody else, or they might land on, say, a doorknob, and somebody touches it while the virus is still viable, and then they take it in. So it all comes down to those droplets. And those droplets, they will hang in the air under certain conditions. And those conditions, it appears, are really, really good in the winter in terms of humidity and temperature and so on. Whereas in the summer, the conditions are such that the droplets tend to just fall right out. Another factor is that, in the fall, kids get together in school for a new school year, and viruses love that because now you're bringing together a whole bunch of hosts. A few of them may already have the flu, and then they can spread those to other kids, along with lots of other viruses. So it's this combination of factors that makes winter into flu season. And so here in the United States, that's when we get the flu. And in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the reverse. In our summer, they're dealing with the flu.
My guest is science writer Carl Zimmer. He teaches at Yale University and has a new book out called A Planet of Viruses. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour, science writer Carl Zimmer. He teaches at Yale and is author of the new book, A Planet of Viruses. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Carl, based on what you have described so far, viruses tend to be really specific and specialized to whatever it is that they eat and whatever it is they latch onto in order to reproduce. So what causes certain viruses to jump species?
Well, this is the big question for scientists who study viruses, because the answer to that question is going to help them figure out what the next new virus plague is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know sort of the general rules for how viruses jump from one species to the other. We know that they do. And it basically seems that, viruses need to be able to get into sort of similar hosts, go from one host to maybe a species that's pretty closely related and has similar biology. So, for example, HIV seemed to come out of nowhere in the 1980s, but when scientists actually looked carefully at the virus and then looked for related viruses, they realized that HIV evolved from a virus that infected chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are our closest living relatives, and so we share a lot of similar biology. And so we're just similar enough that the chimp virus was able to start infecting our cells, probably not doing a very good job at first, but then it evolved and adapted to our own biology, and then it became a human virus. So that probably happens a lot with viruses going from one animal to another. I just wrote an article for the New York Times a couple weeks ago about hepatitis C, which scientists have been wondering where it came from, and it looks as if it might have come from dogs, because they've just discovered a very hepatitis C-like virus that is infecting dogs in dog shelters. What's strange is that in us, it infects our liver and causes scarring in the liver. In dogs, it's a respiratory disease. It basically gives them pneumonia. So it seems to have somehow made that hop and then evolved to shift from being a virus in the airway to a virus in the liver.
So what kinds of drug treatments are effective at eliminating viruses, given that they don't have quite the same life cycle? They don't have the same life cycle as a lot of other living things.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of medicines that are effective for other diseases are not effective for viruses. So, if you have a cold or the flu, you shouldn't expect your doctor to give you antibiotics like penicillin. They won't do any good. Penicillin is a drug that is for bacteria and bacteria only. It is able to jam up the molecular machinery inside bacteria. With viruses, there's no molecular machinery there to mess up, so it's useless. And in fact, you don't want to be taking antibiotics unnecessarily, because then you're going to get resistant bacteria evolving as well. So then what do we do about viruses? Well, there's not a lot can do for a lot of diseases once you're already sick. So, for example, there's no really good proven effective treatment for the common cold. I mean, it's one of the most common diseases around, and there's really nothing effective for it. I mean, there are some suggestions that, if you take zinc or so on, that it might help, but the evidence is pretty shaky. The flip side, though, is that, fortunately, we have vaccines for lots of viruses, particularly the really dangerous ones. And one of the great triumphs of modern medicine is that we've actually been able to reduce and in some cases even eradicate viruses. So, for example, smallpox used to kill tens of millions of people every year. It probably was the worst plague in human history. It's gone from human populations. You can only find it now in laboratories. And there's even some debate now, maybe we should just destroy those final stocks and be done with it. So that's an amazing accomplishment.
Is it every virus that preys on human cells that once you've had it, you're immune to it, or is that only a certain subset?
Yeah, it's only a certain subset. I mean, it's pretty complex. how your immune system deals with different viruses. I mean, there are some cases where if you get a virus and you fight it off, you're done. You don't have to worry about it because, in a sense, your immune system retains a memory of it. But there are other cases where you might feel better, but actually the virus is lurking inside of you, and it can lurk there for decades even in some cases. And then in a case like the flu, I mean, you can fight off an infection of the flu, and you will get some immunity, but only to that particular strain. And so if a new strain of flu emerges, as they often do, you could just as easily get sick with that. You don't have that much protection left over from when you were sick before. And that's why we need to get flu vaccines every year, because the flu viruses are they're sort of in this constant evolutionary turning, and they're swapping genes with each other, and then the flu ultimately comes from birds, so there's always this fresh supply of bird flu viruses that is in effect kind of trying to get into our species, and so there's this constant mixing, and you end up with lots of small and large changes in the flu that are making us sick, and that's why we need vaccines all the time.
What? How have viruses affected the human genome?
Actually, viruses have affected them a lot. This is something that's really just been coming to light in the past, I'd say, couple decades, as scientists have started to really read the human genome and look at the DNA in there. Every now and then, you'll come across a stretch of DNA that bears lots of hallmarks of having come from a virus.
Hmm.
We've got viruses in our DNA. In fact, we've probably got about 100,000 stretches of DNA that came from viruses. And what happened was that certain kinds of viruses, they insert their DNA into our own genes. So, for example, HIV does that. Lots of other viruses do it, too. So if one of these viruses just happens to infect, let's say, an egg instead of, a skin cell or a white blood cell, that egg could develop into an embryo and into an adult, and every cell in that adult will be carrying that virus DNA.
Hmm.
And this has been going on for, over 100 million years. Every now and then, our ancestors picked up these viruses, and they got made part of our genome. So there's a huge amount of the human genome that comes from viruses.
Why do some viruses mutate so quickly, like the flu virus, and others, like smallpox, which has been eradicated, are pretty stable over time?
Well, all viruses mutate a lot faster than we do, for example,
mm-hmm.
or even bacteria, but there are some among them that are really fast mutators. So, like the flu and HIV are incredibly fast. They're some of the fastest mutating things on Earth. And one of the reasons is that they're just these pieces of genetic material, and they don't have any way of fixing mistakes that might get introduced into new viruses. We actually have lots of proteins whose job it is to basically act like proofreaders. And they look at new DNA that our cells are making and make sure that there aren't mistakes, and they are actually able to correct a huge number of them. So we have relatively few mutations. Viruses don't have that. And so that's one reason that viruses can outwit our medicine, because they have the capacity to evolve really quickly. They actually will even evolve just over the course of your being sick. They're evolving in your own body, adapting to your immune system, for example.
So, as you probably know, Carl, here in Texas, we like tall tales, and we have a lot of fun with them. I had assumed, until I read your book, that the jackalope was only that, something silly that somebody came up with. But in fact, there's a basis in observation for rabbits with horns.
That's right. I mean, if you go into some store and you see a postcard for sale, saying, greetings from Wyoming, and it's got this picture of a rabbit with antelope antlers on it, you think, well, this can't be real. That particular jackalope is not real, but the fact is that that myth is actually based on some reality. Every now and then you will see rabbits or hares with strange kind of antler-like growths. They're not hard like horn. They're actually kind of more sort of flesh. virus gets into the skin cells in these rabbits, and what happens is that it, instead of just killing the cells off, they speed the growth of the cells up so that they're dividing faster than the other cells in a rabbit's body. And they grow so fast that they create these strange growths that look a little like antlers. And so, these things aren't necessarily fatal to the rabbits unless they obstruct their mouth and then they can't eat, for example. But papillomaviruses are all over the place. And, you know, we humans have our own set of papillomaviruses that live in us. And most of us actually have it on our skin. We're able to keep it in check. The problem is that it can get quite dangerous if it's passed sexually. So, for example, it's the cause of cervical cancer. So these viruses, they, for some reason, when they infect the cervix in a woman, it's a similar lining of the cells, but there they grow so fast that they create very aggressive tumors. And so what that means is that you can actually fight this particular kind of cancer with a vaccine. So that you can actually create a cancer vaccine, and it's very effective. And ultimately, we know about that because somebody heard about this story about jackalopes and decided to investigate and discover these viruses living in them.
So what relationship might viruses have to other kinds of cancer?
Viruses have been estimated to cause about 15% of all cancers.
Wow.
Yeah, so not just it's not just cervical cancer, but a number of other cancers seem to be caused by viruses as well. And actually, that could be an underestimate because there may be a lot of viruses that are lurking around that are leading to cancer that we just don't know about. Another factor, you know, that where viruses are involved in cancer is that, you know, when we develop tumors. The cancer cells sometimes seem to switch on some of that virus DNA I was talking about before that's actually in our own genome. And they might be somehow making virus proteins that help them grow faster and be successful as tumors, which is kind of spooky.
So is that potentially the link? You know, sometimes, you know, there are genes associated with cancers. Those genes might have to be switched on by the presence of a virus introduced into the body?
In some cases, yeah, that seems to be what's happening. Is that there are, as you say, these viruses that are, I'm sorry, these genes that are associated with cancer, human genes.
Yeah.
Normally, they would be involved in cells growing and dividing. The virus gets in and basically starts to manipulate those genes, and you know, maybe has them make a lot more protein than they would normally. Switches them on when they're switched off, or switches them off when they're switched on. In any case, a virus like a papillomavirus can conduct this very complicated manipulation and cause these cells to grow faster. I mean, cell division is a really complicated process, and scientists haven't worked out all the steps involved, and yet these little viruses are able to carry it out with incredible sophistication.
One thing that's really remarkable about looking at this branch of science is how relatively new it is. I mean, obviously, we needed really high-power microscopes to even understand that viruses existed. But until just a couple of decades ago, there were a lot of places on the Earth. You mentioned the ocean, but other places, you know, underground caves and things very remote from where anything lives. We assumed there were no viruses there, but in fact, they're chock full.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the science has advanced as we've gotten better technology. So, you know, one of the techniques that scientists can use now is they can just go someplace and scoop up some water, some soil, or what have you, and then apply chemicals to it. They basically pull out any DNA that's inside of there. And they can sequence the DNA and just look at it and figure out what it belonged to. So you can actually say, well, this came from a virus. Maybe we don't know exactly what kind of virus, but it's viral DNA. So instead of trying to, like, raise viruses in a culture dish, you just go out there and just go hunting for DNA. And as you say, yeah, I mean, you find viruses all over the place. I mean, basically, just about anywhere there's a water, there's some bacteria, and anywhere there are bacteria, there are lots of viruses. So there are viruses any place you can imagine.
Let's talk about bacteriophages, because you've mentioned that naturally viruses are interested in eating a lot of different kinds of bacteria. And there was a really strong branch of medical science looking into this before we had antibiotics and sort of stopped paying attention.
Yeah, this is one of the wonderful forgotten chapters in the history of medicine. So in World War One, there were soldiers dying of infectious diseases, and doctors really couldn't do much for them. Antibiotics would not be invented for another 20 years or so. And there was this Canadian doctor named Felix Durel working in France examining patients who were sick with dysentery, French soldiers. And he would filter out stool samples until he was left with this totally clear liquid. There weren't any bacteria left in it at all. And he found that if he took a drop of that clear liquid and put it into a dish of bacteria, the kind that caused dysentery, the bacteria died.
Hmm.
And he concluded that this must mean there were viruses that infected bacteria. And this was a really radical idea at the time, and actually a lot of big-name scientists refused to believe it and tried to prove that he was wrong. He turned out to be right, actually, and he very quickly realized that he could use that as a kind of medicine itself, as a weapon against bacteria. And he actually went into business and started selling sort of concoctions made up of these viruses that attack different kinds of bacteria that make us sick. And it was quite successful. It was a big business, and the British government hired him to dump these viruses into the Indian water supply and things like that. I mean, it was on a huge scale, but then all of a sudden antibiotics were discovered, and boom, the whole thing fell apart. People really preferred antibiotics.
We'll talk more about that in just a minute. My guest this hour is science writer Carl Zimmer. He teaches at Yale and has a new book out now called A Planet of Viruses. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Carl Zimmer. His new book is called A Planet of Viruses. Join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Carl, antibiotics have served us long and well, but now we are seeing such a rise in these antibiotic-resistant bacteria. How seriously is bacteriophage research being taken these days as an alternative to pathogens that are no longer responding to antibiotics?
There's a lot of interest in trying to use these viruses, these bacteriophages that infect bacteria, to fight disease. As we were talking about before, the whole movement kind of faded out in the 1930s, as antibiotics became all the rage, although the tradition carried on actually in the Soviet Union, and for decades Soviet researchers would continue to work on developing what's called phage therapy, and a lot of this work came to light, came to the attention of Western scientists after the fall of the Soviet Empire. And so now there are actually a lot of former Soviet scientists who were in the United States and other places working to try to make this a possibility. It's tricky, though, because in the United States, for example, the FDA is not very comfortable about approving viruses as a drug, which is essentially what you're doing. So there's a lot of built-in resistance to that. And yet, you know, the experiments people have done have shown that it's potentially really effective. And you could avoid a lot of the problems we've had with antibiotics. The problem with antibiotics is that, you know, you give people penicillin, and then there are mutant bacteria that can resist penicillin, and they don't die out, and then you have these mutations that give resistance to penicillin that are all over the place. And then you just keep on adding more and more and more of these mutations, and you end up with bacteria that are carrying genes that make them resistant to lots of different antibiotics. I mean, we have some bacteria that are resistant to just about anything we can throw at them. And it's very difficult at this point to come up with new antibiotics. It takes years and years of testing.
So if you have a phage virus, does it mutate as quickly as the bacteria it's supposed to be eating?
Well, you know, the reason that phages can still infect bacteria after billions of years is that while the bacteria become resistant to the phages evolve to be resistant to them. Yeah, and so you could actually direct the evolution in a laboratory. You could breed viruses. You know, let's say that you had an infection. You went to the hospital. They would take a sample of your bacteria. Conceivably, they could test out different viruses on it and find the most effective one. Maybe they could engineer it, add a gene in there, and then come back and then just apply a pad soaked in viruses on the infection and could potentially cure the infection.
So what explains the FDA's reluctance here? Is it a sense somehow, maybe not related necessarily to the science, that people will just be freaked out by introducing viruses deliberately into their bodies?
Well, you know, there are a lot of questions about how you can be absolutely sure it's safe.
Yeah.
The FDA has a lot of procedures put in place to assess the safety of something like penicillin. I mean, they can do that. But how do you assess the safety of something that, as we just said, has the capacity to evolve? How do you do that? The FDA isn't really sure about it, and actually, you know, some of the people who are at the forefront of phage therapy are taking some interesting sidetracks as a result. So there's one group that wants to use viruses to clean up buildings. HVAC systems actually get overrun with films of bacteria, and so the cooling and heating becomes very expensive as a result of all this stuff growing in the vents. So what they're planning on doing is releasing viruses into these ducts and killing all the bacteria and saving the owners of the building a lot of money. So if they can't cure people just yet, maybe they can cure buildings.
That's really interesting. It does sound like something that, you know, you'd have to really talk to the employees about what was about to take place here.
Well, you know, that's true, but, you know, a little bit of virus biology could go a long way in that case.
Yeah.
You just have to remind people, as we just said, that, you know, there are 4 trillion viruses in each of us, and those are all these same phages. We eat phages in foods like yogurt or pickles, like, every day. They don't make us sick because they cannot infect our own cells. They will not be able to evolve the ability to infect ourselves because we and bacteria are separated by 3 billion years of evolution. And these viruses are very well adapted to bacteria, not to humans.
What is a retrovirus?
A retrovirus is one of these viruses that actually is able to insert its DNA into its host cell in animals, for example. So HIV is a retrovirus. And so retroviruses are the kind of virus that has played a really important part in basically making our genomes full of viruses. We're full of retroviruses.
So they're harder to, are they harder to eliminate from the body?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, it's just that they have a different strategy than other viruses. So, you know, flu viruses, for example, they don't actually insert their genes into our own DNA. Their genes just sort of float around and are replicated and then are packaged up into new viruses without actually, like, sort of merging with us.
So some people might disagree with me, Carl, but a lot of these viruses, you know, under highly magnified, are actually sort of beautiful to look at. Is there anything about the shape of them that clues us into what they might do or how we might fight them or grow them?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, viruses are are quite beautiful. you know, sometimes when you look at just the pictures that are taken under microscopes, they're kind of fuzzy and blurry because they're so tiny. But if you look instead at computer visualizations that show actually like how the proteins fit together, they have this astonishing kind of geometrical elegance. You know, bacteria is just kind of a big blob, but viruses are like they're like geodesic domes. The phages, a lot of phages actually look like the lunar landing module that the Apollo mission sent to the moon, with kind of little legs that land on a cell. So yeah, so they're quite lovely. And, you know, that just has to do with basically the fact that they've got these protein shells, and these proteins form into crystals, you know, these geometrical structures. So a lot of actually what scientists do in trying to fight viruses is to figure out what that protein shell does. You know, how does that protein shell latch onto our cells? Can we block that process? You know, can we make it impossible for them to take those beautiful shells and use them like keys to get into our own cells. So, yeah, there is a lot to learn from them.
What theories exist as to the role that viruses might have played in the origins of life on Earth?
Well, they probably had some sort of role. I mean, it used to be thought that viruses were just kind of cast off bits of DNA that just sort of became parasitic. And so that meant that they were pretty recent. Actually, it's pretty clear that virus genes can be very, very different than genes in bacteria or animals, plants, or other living things. And so they could represent a very, very, very ancient branch of evolution. And so, you know, there probably were viruses just from the very start. As soon as there were genes that were making copies of themselves, there were probably some of those genes were cheating, mm-hmm. and getting other genes to make copies of themselves. And so you probably had viruses from the start, and they were probably very intimately wrapped up with life itself for 4 billion years.
Is there any respected theory that there are viruses floating around in space somewhere?
I wouldn't say respected. I mean, there were...
I'm not talking about the Andromeda strain or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, you know, there were some scientists who would claim that the flu and other viruses would actually sort of rain down from space on us, and that's where they came from. You know, now we know a lot more about exactly where diseases like the flu come from. You know, we know how new strains of flu virus come from birds, particularly in Southeast Asia. We've got that all mapped out. So this appeal to the skies doesn't work as much. Now, but I don't want to poo-poo the science fiction too much because, you know, it's possible, for example, that there is still life on Mars, like hiding underneath the surface, maybe some microbes in the earth down there. In the ground there. So, you know, I would not be surprised if they had their own viruses infecting them. Now, one thing that would be very interesting to think about is what happened if a meteorite hit Mars and rock got kicked up into space and eventually came into the Earth's atmosphere, bringing with it perhaps some of these bacteria and maybe some of the viruses. Could they survive the trip through space? You know, we don't really know, but you can at least think about what it would be like if Martian viruses landed on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would just die off, but who knows?
And I guess it could get, you know, we talk so much, or not so much, but occasionally about terraforming Mars. I suppose it could work the other way around.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, there have been suggestions that maybe it would have been easier for life to have begun on Mars, and then, in a sense, Earth might have been infected by Martian meteorites.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually an idea that people talk about without getting, you know, laughed off the stage these days. There's not a lot of evidence one way or the other about it. If we find life on Mars, then we'll really be able to talk about this seriously. And, you know, if there are viruses there, then maybe viruses came from Mars long, long ago. Who knows? But we don't know enough about life in general to say too much one way or the other.
We have an email here from Renee who wants to know, is there any common aspect of a virus, something that makes it a virus by definition, that is susceptible to a common factor like desiccation or electricity? Is there one thing that we know will do in every virus?
There is not one thing that will do in every virus. I mean, and boy, if we knew that one thing, we would be using it like crazy because then we'd have a cure for every viral disease. But, viruses generally work on in the same way, the way I was describing before, finding a host and using it to make copies of itself. But the details of how it uses its host can be very different from species to species. And so, you know, there are drugs you can take to fight HIV and antivirals, but those aren't going to help someone who has the flu, for example, because they're different beasts.
We should say, for anyone who happens to be suffering through a summer cold right now, that there is some evidence that having sort of low-grade viral infections might protect against more serious diseases later on.
Yeah, this is part of a kind of a broad theory called the hygiene hypothesis, which is that, our ancestors didn't evolve with antibiotics and with lots of modern medicine. And so there's some evidence that suggests that our immune system develops kind of in concert with infections with viruses, with bacteria, with maybe even parasitic worms. So, for example, you find like kids who are like playing the dirt or grew up on farms. When they get older, they tend to have much lower rates of things like asthma and allergies. And it could be that their immune system was trained the right way early on. And viruses, like cold viruses, might be part of that. I mean, that doesn't mean that you want to get smallpox as a kid. But it does suggest that maybe, yeah, if you do have a cold, especially if you're young, it might not be such a terrible thing. It might do you some good in the long run. It's possible.
Are you any more reluctant today than you used to be to open your mouth while you're swimming in the ocean?
I'm not worried about getting those phages. But there are certainly a fair number of viruses out there that I do worry about. I think that we do need to be on our guard about the next HIV or the next flu. Where is it going to come from? It might come from bats. Come from some species of monkey. Who knows? Maybe come from dogs. We don't know. And that's.
I'm going to have to jump in here, Carl. I'm so sorry. We're out of time. Carl Zimmer's new book is called A Planet of Viruses. Carl, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.